Good evening and welcome to another episode of Boo, My Dad Says. My name is John.
And I'm Becca.
And we are your tour guides through the world of the paranormal.
We've got a whole lot of history, a whole lot of mystery, and a whole lot of weird.
So sit back, relax, and prepare for a spine-tingling time. Good evening, everybody out there in podcast land. How y'all doing tonight?
Hello, hello, hello.
My dearest wife, Becca, how are we doing today?
Oh, we're just peachy. I had a terrible weekend. I had a migraine. I was barfing everywhere. It was lovely.
Yeah, we actually thought she had the old Ronas.
But thankfully, I did not have the Rona. I must have just had some kind of ridiculous weather-related migraine, maybe. I don't know. But I feel much better now.
Thank goodness.
Because John was having to do a whole lot of work and he didn't like it.
I was babying my dear wife, just petting on her.
Yeah. He says, I'm going to shut the door. Let me know. Text me if you need me.
Put your mask on.
Yeah, it was pretty unpleasant.
Yeah, she was. That's probably the most pitiful I've seen her in a long time.
Yeah, I'm usually pretty tough, but this weekend, it just knocked me flat on my butt after school on Friday. I came home and I thought I was going to die.
Well,
speaking of dead things.
Yeah, speaking of dead things, I have definitely had my sleep paralysis experience for the year.
And it's only February. Look at that.
Yeah, no, I know. I got it out of the way in a hurry. A little side note, I've started some new medication, and one of the
side effects can be, okay, I'm not laughing about this part, but it's like sleep paralysis, vivid dreams, nightmares, and hallucinations. And I was like, when the pharmacist told us that, I was like, dude, what kind of hallucinations are we talking about? Are we talking about like seeing floating objects, or are we like seeing people? Like, what's going on here?
Well, anyways, I definitely had the sleep paralysis and very vivid dreams last
Scared
night.
Scared the Jesus out of me this morning and
Our
the dog.
Our poor dog just about came
cracked
unhinged.
His pants.
But I was dreaming that we were at a relative's house down on the coast of North Carolina where they used to live. And we were trying to cook something in the oven. And
because that's what I do. That's how I roll. I'm a baker. I'm a cook. That part is accurate.
Well, anyway, so I look in the oven and I see some like flames going on.
I don't do that.
Amongst other things, there was like full sticks of butter and all sorts of stuff.
Why would you
do weird.
That? This
and
was
then
apparently
I see
not me.
These sparks coming from behind it. And then I look and this guy kind of pops up like he's an electrician. And he's like, quick, go to the box and cut off the breaker. So I'm going back to the box, and there was the little guide on the door was blank. So I was trying to figure out where the 220 breaker was in order to turn it off. And I see this clipboard, and I'm trying to flip through. I maybe had the diagram on it. Well, the next thing I know, I see Becca come up from behind me, and then she started like doing this attack, and I realized that she was a zombie.
Anyway, he screamed bloody freaking murder this morning at like 5 o'clock.
I couldn't move.
The dog shot out of the bed. I shot up.
I was aware of what was happening, but I couldn't move. It was just like I was going, help, help.
And then he goes, finally,
it was crazy.
I mean, I'm laughing about it now, but I don't like dreams like that either. No. But
I mean, you know, she sounded like Gollum from The Lord
My
of the Rings.
Gollum, Gollum.
You know, that noise, you know, kind of got that phlegm in the back of the throat.
Ew.
And it scared the bejeebers out of me. And I couldn't get woke up. And, you know, and she had me pressed up against the wall.
Okay, in the dream, not in real life. Let's clarify that. Anyway, yeah. The zombie Becca was on the attack apparently last night. So we'll see what dreams we have in store for you next week.
Becca is not a very pleasant zombie, let me tell you. So anyways,
I ain't got nothing to add to that. I can neither confirm nor deny.
Anyways, dear, why don't you tell them how they can get in touch with us?
Okay, so if you have a story you want to share, or if we totally butcher a pronunciation of something that you know the correct pronunciation of, please send us an email at john@boomydadsays.com. And you can also check out our show notes to get in contact with us with all of our social media accounts.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome very much.
So tonight we are going to be picking up with part two of our journey through New Orleans.
Part deux.
Part deux. That's two in deux speak.
François. Oh. François. Okay. Swede. Mm-hmm. Spanish. Espanole.
And we have got a really good show planned out. We're going to do two different locations tonight. And promise it won't be as long as it was last week. Last week just had a lot of history and a lot of lead up that we had to get through. So, Becca, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Sultan's Palace?
Are we like on Aladdin with the Sultan?
Prince Ali, fabulous he, Ali Ababwa.
The legend of the Sultan's Palace. In the year of 1836, when the structure of 716, how did I say that? Dauphine? Dauphine?
Dauphine.
I think it's Dauphine. Dauphine Street was built. There was this guy. His name was Joseph Coulon Gardet. And that's probably Gardet, I would say, maybe in French. I don't know. He had arrived in New Orleans just a few years earlier because he was going to become the dentist of the Crescent City. I mean, who really, like, moves to a city and says, I'm going to be the best? Well, maybe you do. I don't know. I'm going to be this dentist in the city here. So apparently, after about 4 years or so, business was booming. He commissioned the local architect, Frederick Roy, to design him a stately home. It was a 3.5-story mansion. It was a knockout. It even had a raised half basement, which apparently was something pretty uncommon back then in New Orleans.
I had no idea that dentistry back then was such a lucrative business.
Well, you know, all those people and their teeth rotting out of their head. They had to pull them and give them partials, who knows? Anyway, so after a few years after that, he was going to sell this beautiful home at the corner of Dauphine and Orleans Street. And the person who won the bid was Jean-Baptiste Lepret. He was a wealthy bank merchant and a plantation. Oops, I just hit the microphone. Sorry about that.
Shame.
A wealthy plantation owner, and he purchased the property for an astounding $20,000, $20,049 in 1839. And if you think about how much money that was back then, it was $561,000. $561,531.53 today. And that's a pretty big increase over the 142 years.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I don't know if that article said how big the mansion was, but
just that it was 3.5 stories high and it had a raised half basement to boot. Which I guess because of the floodplain and the water situation down there, that being under sea level, you wouldn't really have a basement because anytime it rained, you would be in a heap of trouble.
Because remember last week we talked about how they can't even bury their dead. They have to have them in above ground.
So these had a half basement to attend to. So who knows what was down there. But in the 1850s, so this new owner, Jean-Baptiste Lepret, he hired a builder to add an ornate wrought iron lace to the balconies. So he's getting all fancy up in here. And then eventually the Civil War erupted and he has this beautiful place. And in the 1860s, the family's financial stability crumbled. They could not maintain the upkeep of the house. The economic downturn following the war was a burden that they could not lift, no matter how hard that they tried. So Jean-Baptiste Lepret decided to lease their mansion. He was soon approached by a man of Middle Eastern descent. He explained to Lebret that his brother, who just happened to be a sultan, was interested in renting the property. So here he decides, like, okay, crap, I need money. So yeah, sure, let's do this thing. So the contracts were signed, and he was like, shoo, okay, gonna have some money coming in. So soon after, a ship arrived in the port of New Orleans, and everybody disembarked and got off the boat. There were the women. They were dressed to the nines. They were these men, the eunuchs, who were dressed in dark military
clothing.
Sounds
like the Kardashians came to town.
Them Kardashians, yes. Kardashian part one. Also, these men in these dark military clothing, they each carried a long bayonet. Then the brother of the sultan, then the sultan himself, and lastly came all the furniture. There were beds and vases and portraits and rugs and so many pieces that the locals were just sitting there slack-jawed watching all this stuff come off the boat like, good gracious, who in the world is this?
You know, and if you think about it, you know, back then, considering, you know, if that was right after the Civil War and the economic downturn that we talk about, you know, those folks there were probably just very, I guess, envious of all that, because, you know, the South was pretty much devastated after the Civil War.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, maybe envious, maybe a little suspicious, thinking like, where's this guy getting all his money? So over the next few months, this place was a hub of excitement. You could hear music coming from the street. They would hear the giggling of women and the deep masculine chuckles of the men. They would hear distinct sounds of pleasure. We'll leave that there. The scent of opium wafting from the open windows was never far behind. And all the New Orleans people, the locals, they were rather put out, and they got pretty ticked off that they never got invited to any of these lavish parties that the Sultan was throwing. No matter, they must have thought, as they had for the umpteenth time, and that darkness was falling over the French Quarter, the locals were never allowed inside of the Sultan's Palace, as it became nicknamed. Goods were placed on the doorstep. If you had to deliver anything, you just left it there. And payment in the form of gold was put in its place the very next morning. And so there was no contact between the local people and the Sultan and his people. Then, one night, a few months later, a really bad storm came and hit the city, and everyone in the French Quarter was hunkered down, batting the hatches, getting ready, dimming their candles, closing their shutters. The wind was absolutely howling.
You know, it's really something how it seems like everything that happens in New Orleans revolves around a storm.
Yeah, it's a little creepy. So the next morning, the sky was absolutely beautiful, and it looked like it hadn't even ever rained at all. And there was one man who was just strolling down the street, enjoying the beautiful morning. And as he passed the Sultan's palace, he saw, but what? Blood looked like a river trickling, then flowing out of the Sultan's palace. It ran like a river, pooling in the divots of the uneven stone. When the police arrived on the scene, the blood ran thicker and deeper. They all just looked at one another nervously, and they opened the door, and a collective intake of breath echoed loudly, otherwise silent house.
As you can tell, my wife is an elementary school teacher.
Shut your face. Corpses. I don't talk about corpses in third grade, though. Corpses littered the ground. Some had been flayed open, while others were missing limbs, as if some savage beast had sought devilish revenge. The metallic scent of exposed blood lingered in the air. One officer turned and vomited. Another did too. The sight, the smell. Oh, Lord, they whispered, who had done such a thing? But the farther in through the house that they went, the sight only got worse. The dilapidated dead. In the courtyard, they found the worst crime of all. The soil, it was wet and muddy from the heavy rain the night before, and sticking out of the ground was a single hand, fingers spread wide as if clawing for help. The Sultan himself had been buried alive. Who in the world committed these tragic murders? Police imagined that blame lay at the brother of the blame lay at the feet of the brother of the Sultan, whose body was never found. Maybe he had an assistant. Maybe he hired a hitman. Maybe he did it himself. We will never know. The story that I just told you was just one of many that are told, one of many versions that are told about the Gardette Lepret house or the Sultan's palace. Okay, there are some historical truths. There's some historical truth in all legend. There's usually a little nugget of truth in there. Okay, there's no proof. There are no newspaper accounts of what researchers can find that lends credence to the tale. The only mention of the Sultans in New Orleans in the New Orleans papers are those about those still living in the Middle East.
You know, I think the biggest question that really comes into my head about this story that makes it seem a little more along the lines of legend is why? I mean, why does
anybody kill anybody?
Well, no, I mean, even before that, why did the Sultan come over here and want to spend all that time here, especially, you know, in the South that has been ransacked from the Civil War, which, I mean, I'm sure the North also had its fair share of destruction also, but, you know, the South, you know, being at in the economic straits that it was in and things like that, you know, why would the Sultan come to New Orleans?
Who knows? By 1922, this legend of mass massacre had stuck, and it was cemented fully when Helen Pitkin Schertz penned the tale in her book, Legends of Louisiana. For better or for worse, this tale was sealed. In the 1940s, the New Orleans Academy of Art had taken up residence, but was forced to close shortly when too many of its students were drafted into World War II. Once again, the Grand Mansion became home to the homeless and remained such until 1966 when it was purchased. The owners then, Frank D'Amico and Anthony Vesic, after a large-scale restoration and renovation, they converted the property into 6 independent apartments, and it still exists today. Even though it is under different ownership, it is still as an apartment. Who exactly is haunting the Gardette Lepret House, the Sultan's Palace? So here, in 1979, Frank D'Amico's wife had just climbed into bed for the night. She lived up in the penthouse up on the upper floor. And when she described it, she said that there was a dark figure standing at the foot of her bed, and it began to approach her. When she panicked, hello, and scrambled to turn on the lamp sitting beside the bedside table. The lights flickered on, illuminating all the hidden corners, but no one was there.
Come back, Becca. Don't run off.
Shut up. The spirit of the Sultan's palace. So here, the strange phenomenon, one of the other, Nina Nivens, purchased the property. She didn't think anything about the murders that allegedly occurred here, but she said that sometimes personal belongings tended to go missing. Keys were a particular favorite of the spirits in the apartment building. And then going on, other historians and paranormal enthusiasts, James Caskey, said that there seem to be 2 main ghosts that hunt the Sultan's palace. It's unlikely that either one are a result of this 19th century murder. The first ghost is that of the Confederate soldier who is still haunting the house in his uniform. And then the other one, let's see, that there's a dog? Apparently there's a dog who is in the living room. So we have a Confederate soldier and a dog ghost, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's another thing, and kind of lends a little more credence to the fact that this, you know, murder was legend, because if that many people were murdered, that blood was absolutely running out into the streets, you would think that place would be haunted to the gills.
Maybe.
So
hard to say. But why would they make that up? And why would there be all these stories of people vomiting and turning away?
It is rather detailed.
The metallic smell of the dried blood. I mean, that's pretty specific.
That is rather detailed. But then again, it was, you know, probably added on to by, what was the author, the book that?
Oh, Caskey?
Yeah.
Could be.
You know, she probably romanticized it a little bit. But who knows? We'll let you guys decide on the legitimacy of that tale. So our next location, and this one, guys, is a really good one.
Do I need to run away now?
No, not necessarily. I mean, there's just, it's just a very, good location. I mean, there's a lot of spirits hanging out here. But nothing, you know, nothing that would, you would say malicious, so to speak.
That's good.
So, but we are going to be visiting the Haunted Le Petit Theater, and it's located at 616 St. Peter in New Orleans. And this account that I found, the history and everything, it's just so good that I'm going to have to actually just read it verbatim because it's really good. And I found this on Ghost City Tours. And just want to give them a shout out, you know, because I am reading from their, some of their information, but it's really good, really good research, and it deserves to be out there in the, for the world to hear. So if you're visiting out of town and you want to catch a show, you can't beat the French Quarter's on Le Petit Theater Duvaux Carr, C-A-R-R-E.
Oh no, you should look that up before we started.
I should look that one up, but it sounds a lot funnier when I try to mispronounce the words.
Perhaps.
You know? Le Petit is New Orleans' most historic playhouse. The theater was established in 1916 and has operated at its current location at 616 St. Peter Street since 1922. The theater plays host to performing arts, special events, live music, and wedding receptions, not far from the St. Louis Cathedral. Le Petit Theater, literally the small theater, is known as a great venue because of their two stages, historic lobby, and private courtyard. Le Petit is more than just a center for performances and functions, though. It's a community theater, and as such, it also hosts many characters. But not all of them are living. Le Petit has a variety of haunting tales ranging from legends of a gentlemanly ghost to the spirit of a nun. Le Petit Theater's history is comparable to many of the plays it has featured over the years. It's been a history filled with behind-the-scenes drama and unexpected plot twists. In the year of 1916, a group of neighbors gathered together and began referring to themselves as the Drawing Room Players. They created a place where amateurs could learn and hone their talents. Back in the day, these performances proved to be quite the draw. The audiences of the Drawing Room Players grew so large that the founders decided to rent a space on the second floor of 503 St. Anne in the lower Pontalba buildings for $17.50 per month. Man, I can't beat that for rent. Of course, mm-hmm. Back then, that's probably quite a chunk.
That's true.
The theater was formally launched when the Irish playwright Lord Dunsany, Edward, well, I guess also known as Edward Plunkett, came to the city for a visit. In 1922, the theater relocated to its current site when it bought the property at the corner of St. Peter and Charles Streets. They removed the smaller structures that faced toward St. Peter Street and began construction of the theater. The architect of Le Petit, Richard Koch, or Koch, K-O-C-H, designed the theater in the Spanish colonial style. Most of the members of the group were well-respected individuals of the city, their professions ranging from politicians of the day to artists. At the time, most of the people who would attend their plays were upper class, while from the beginning of the theater's history, they claimed to be all-inclusive. Le Petit was not exactly open to all of the public. Now, there were some turbulent years with this theater, though. It wasn't all roses, as it sounds like it was up to this point. So the director, Bernard Zold, S-Z-O-L-D, left the theater due to an illness in the year of 1940. But the unofficial reason why he left was the fact the theater was struggling financially. The position was taken over by Charles Meredith, who made wide-sweeping changes and improvements to Le Petit. In his two seasons as director, he doubled members to the maximum 3,000. Meredith also increased the number of productions per season and created a school for the theater. The theater.
Oh, I love the theater.
The corner building was later reconstructed in 1963 to hold an additional theater as well as new dressing rooms. They also added office spaces and rooms to hold receptions. In March of the year 2009, Le Petit was again having financial difficulties, and their board of governors laid off the director and staff. The board then selected Solomon Group, a NOLA entertainment company, to manage the theater in the interim. The experiment, however, failed, and so Solomon Group's contract was terminated and the rest of the 2012-2011 season was canceled. Le Petit received a much-needed booster shot in the arm when it underwent a multi-million dollar renovation between 2012 and 2013.
Who paid for that?
I don't know.
They're going under and they're letting everybody go, but then they have a multi-million dollar renovation. I have questions.
Probably some government funding.
Ooh, government funding.
So, anyhow.
Sorry. Squirrel.
Let's leave the politics aside here.
No politics. I'm just curious.
As part of the deal, a portion of the building, 60%, was sold to Dickie Brennan and Company, in which that said portion of the building became the Creole Cuisine Restaurant, Tableau. In 2013, Le Petit launched a new website and a preseason performance of Nora and Della Ephron's Love, Loss, and What I Wore. The 13-14 season came back strong with classics like Death of a Salesman and Hair.
Hair?
Yeah.
Spray?
I don't know. It just says hair.
Hair. That sounds slightly suspicious.
Yeah, I don't know. For anybody who's losing it, though, it's pretty popular.
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy. We're in rare form tonight, dear.
Keep going. Oh, it's a rock musical. Sorry, I have to Google
okay,
things.
Hair band.
It's like hair, yes.
Okay. New leadership at Le Petit Theater occurred in 2015 with Maxwell Williams being appointed as artistic director and Katie Hallman becoming the managing director. The following year, the theater began preparation for its 100th anniversary with celebrations planned throughout the 2016-2017 season. Maxwell Williams said of the community theater, "It's time for all of this great work that's happening in New Orleans to start to get some recognition. I think by virtue of our building, our history, our personal relationships, and the kind of focus that we can draw here, I think we can get the whole scene recognized." So that's the history of the theater, but no theater seems to go unscathed when it comes to the spirit world. And Le Petit Theater is right at the top of the list. Le Petit Theater is arguably the most haunted playhouse in the world. The theater's original structure was built around the year 1789 when it was destroyed in the New Orleans Second Great Fire in 1794. And it was rebuilt a few years later in 1797 in the Spanish colonial style. And that is still the reflection that is still reflected in its beauty today. The building was later taken over by Union General Benjamin Butler and used as a barracks for the Army during the Civil War. By the Great Depression, like much of the country, the building fell into ruin. But now this is where the theater came in and took over this building. So there was a little bit of history with the building before the theater took it over. So, in 1922, the building was then bought by the Drawing Room Players and was reborn. This resurgence of life awoke many of the building's spirits. Reportedly, the ghosts of Union soldiers even began watering the hallways and the property as a whole. Not all of the theater's ghosts are seen. Some have reported hearing the heavy sounds of Union boots in the hardwood floors and their muffled voices, perhaps discussing military strategy.
Sound like a zombie voice that sounds like Gollum. Sorry.
Oh, gosh. I am never going to live that one down, am I?
No, not until your next one.
You never know, the next one might get me.
Well, as long as that life insurance is paid up.
You all heard it, guys. If something happens
listen
to me.
Listen here. Don't even go there.
So, one of the Union soldiers apparently is a little vain. He has been seen looking at a blank wall as if a mirror was in front of him. He adjusts his clothing and turns side to side, checking for the slightest imperfection. Once he is satisfied with his appearance, he'll smile and then vanish. One of Lapathie's more famous stories happened in their courtyard when there was a wedding. It turned tragic. The cause is unknown, but the bride decided to commit suicide by jumping off the side of the theater. I guess her husband was a really bad kisser or something.
So was this, like, when was this? How recent was that?
It actually doesn't say. It does not say. But it says her lost soul can still be seen standing in the very spot where she took her last breath of air before leaping to her death. Those who have dared to step in that spot for themselves have reportedly become overwhelmed by a sudden drop in temperature. Some have made further claims of seeing the bride's reflection in the water of Lapathie's fountain. So that was pretty tragic. Now, there are a few angry spirits at the playhouse. I mean, nothing like really super malicious, but, you know, just, I guess, a few irritated ghosts, if you will.
They got their britches in a twist.
Yeah, they got their ectoplasm
twisted
all
up.
Messed up, I guess. During one of the drawing room player shows at Le Petit, the ghost of a nun appeared, though her origin still remains unexplained, spooking the cast. She allegedly slapped one of the theater's employees, leaving a vibrant red mark on their face. It's not a fan of the arts.
Apparently.
There is a ghost that is even more feared than the slapping nun, and that is the hellish spirit of a former manager of the theater. It is alleged that the ex-manager, for reasons not known, committed suicide in his office by shooting himself in his head. Employees who have worked late at into the night in that very office have reported feeling the unnerving gaze of the former manager. Others have heard the sounds of banging drawers and slamming doors, and even their personal items have disappeared. A story that has been told a few times happened at the office late one night when a man noticed that his wallet was gone. He had placed it in his desk drawer just a moment before, and there was no one else working that night. The next morning, the man's wallet was found inside the theater, which was locked up, resting on the soundboard.
I think somebody may have been in the secret sauce.
Oh, our resident skeptic, ladies and gentlemen, she finally jumps in.
Isn't that my job?
That is your job. That's why I pay you nothing, dear.
That's right. I'm worth every penny.
But not all the spirits at Le Petit are hostile. Those who have visited the theater at night have been occasionally been treated to the musical talents of a ghostly pianist. Some have speculated that this is the work of composer Louis Moreau Gottschalk, who once graced the theater when it was a dance hall with a transcending performance during the 19th century. This place really has been a lot. A regular at Le Petit is the ghost of an African-American who is believed to have been a manservant. He can usually be spotted solemnly sitting in a chair just outside of the door that leads to the theater. In the early years of Le Petit and other playhouses as well, it was not uncommon sight to see the servants outside the theater walls, forced to wait patiently for hours as their masters and mistresses enjoyed the show. The reason why the ghost of this servant continues to wait is unknown. Regardless of the reason, he ultimately serves as a reminder of the poor treatment that was once deemed acceptable in our society. And lastly, our last spirit that we're going to talk about is Caroline.
Sweet Caroline, bum, 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 good times never, something, something. So good.
Well, I believe people are going to think we've been hitting the sauce.
There's no sauce been had. We had pizza tonight because it's National Pizza Day. Wait, so, well, maybe that was yesterday.
No, it was today.
I know, but we're recording.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, we record on Tuesdays.
So today, Tuesday, is National Pizza Day. Right.
But it's Tuesday, but on a Wednesday.
Yes, there you go.
So the actress Caroline in France. The story behind the ghost of the actress who haunts the catwalk above the theater stage is actually one of the more salacious tales at Le Petit. In the early years of the theater, one of the actresses was having an affair with a maintenance worker. They had snuck up to the catwalk where they engaged in romantic relations. That's what it says, romantic relations.
Romantic relations, not unromantic.
But the actress apparently lost her balance and fell to her death. She was reportedly found unclothed with a broken neck. But the maintenance worker, possibly a drifter, was nowhere to be found. He had fled the theater and was never seen again.
The other half of the romantic escapades?
Yeah, the other half of the romantic escapades.
Well, duh, he ran away. Of course. This naked chick is dead in the floor. Of course he's running away.
Considering the aftermath of the tragedy, there has been speculation.
I mean, are you going to let stick around and wait for somebody to get you in trouble? I mean, hello. Sorry. I'm getting in trouble. I'm getting a stink eye again.
Yeah, you're getting a little bit of a stink eye because
I'm sorry. I'm trying to make it
fun. I was already. You mean we're not fun already?
No, but I'm bringing my personality to the show.
And a lovely personality it is, dear.
Dang straight. Keep going.
Oh my gosh.
Loverboy flew the scene. Fled the scene.
Loverboy left. Just like, you know, love them and leave them.
There you go. Love them and throw them off the balcony.
Yeah. Considering the aftermath of the tragedy.
Shall I finish the story?
No, I got it. Considering the aftermath of the tragedy, there has been speculation on whether or not her death was actually an accident. Her spirit can still be seen on the catwalk,
naked?
Moving in the shadows.
Is it a naked spirit?
I don't know. It doesn't say.
Ah, scary.
Some have said that the actress's name was Caroline and that she is rather helpful in finding missing items around the theater. I wish she'd come around here and help us find some things.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, I got all my faculties intact.
Yeah, like Brady's glasses, Matthew's glasses.
Oh, no, they've done a lot better keeping up with us. The dog usually has the shoes.
Well, yeah, that's true. So, yeah, so she helps find the things that the ex-manager that we talked about earlier has stolen. While others insist that the actress who fell to her death and Caroline are helpful ghosts, but they think the two are different. A friend of Caroline is the former stage carpenter, Sigmund. Unfortunately, Sigmund is not quite as helpful as sweet Caroline. Sigmund is often blamed for when things go wrong with the stage sets. Other mishaps in the theater are reportedly caused by ghostly children. Why is it always ghostly children that are the troublemakers?
Because they be troublemakers in their real life, too.
Yeah.
That's what children's do.
But after all, what haunting building is complete without a couple of miscreant children spirits?
Oh, I thought you were saying some more ghosty dogs.
Well, yeah, it does need some ghost dogs.
Why are there never no ghost cats? That's my question.
Because cats are, like, too evil.
Maybe.
Sorry, Chansey. And he's over there asleep. He don't even care.
Doesn't even care.
So, folks, that was our story for this week. I hope y'all enjoyed it. Next week is going to be part three. It's going to be the finale of New Orleans, although I'm sure I could squeeze two or three more episodes out of New Orleans if I really wanted to. But I think three is a good magic number. So we're gonna end it at three. But I think next week is going to be a very good episode. I've already got a couple things picked out, but I'm not telling.
Neener, neener, neener.
But as always, you know, we really appreciate you guys listening to our show. And, you know, if you like us, go out to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating and review. Subscribe to our show. It really helps us out. But we appreciate everything that you can do for us. If you would like to donate to the show, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/boommydadsays. And make a one-time donation to the show so we can buy Rebecca a new chair.
Lord Jesus, please, I need a new chair. and I'll say this, like the Barter Theater in Abingdon, Virginia, they would always say, Richard Rose, the artistic director, when he would come out for the show, he would say, if you like us, tell your friends about us, and if you don't, keep your mouth shut.
Yes, please tell your friends about us. We really want to grow this show, you know, get out there to more listeners. But as always, folks, I hope you have a great rest of the week. Goodbye.
And happy Valentine's Day. That's coming up on the 14th. Well, it's Sunday.
Oh, is that Sunday?
That's next Sunday.
Oh, wow.
What you got planned for me, babe?
Oh, you'll really like it, dear. I'm promise. Sure.
It's probably like an old crusty chair or something.
No, I'll take you out to eat or something.
Oh, listen to that. Do I get to pick?
Well, of course.
Where am I going to pick?
Carrabba's.
No.
No? Salad Work?
No. Oh, I do love the Salad Work. So if you've not been to Salad Works in Johnson City, you need to hit them up. It is truly excellent. If you are local, go to Salad Works. It's pretty amazing. But no.
I'm all out of guests.
We'll have to see you next week then. Bah.
All right, guys. Good night and God bless.